Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
What today's guests have to say about migrant labor in the United States may surprise you. Donald Trump has proposed immigration reform that would involve mass deportation of immigrants who are in the United States illegally. This deportation plan has echoes of a largely forgotten chapter of American history. In the 1930s, about 1 million people were forced out of the United States across the border into Mexico. It wasn't called deportation, but repatriation, returning people to their native country. But about 60% of the people in the Mexican repatriation drive were actually U.S. citizens of Mexican descent. Later in the hour, novelist and English teacher Karen Halverson Schreck follows a fictional young widow from the Texas Dust Bowl to a Mexican migrant farm workers' camp in California in the 1930s. She sees the mass deportation of people of Mexican heritage. This repatriation campaign was an actual event initiated by the Hoover administration. My first guest is a Spanish instructor at Shasta College in Redding. When Ann Sittig discovered a community of Mayans from Guatemala living in a small meatpacking town in Nebraska, she began gathering oral histories. She met a Mayan community leader named Martha Florinda Gonzalez, and together they set up group dialogues with Mayan women about the psychological, sociological, and economic wounds left by war, poverty, immigration, and residence in a new country. The title of their book is The Mayans Among Us, Migrant Women and Meatpacking on the Great Plains. Ann Sittig, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Nancy.
Now, you also go by Anna, so I think I'll call you Anna if you prefer that.
That'd be great.
Okay. So, Anna Sittig has written this book, and I'm wondering how, you teach Spanish, and I'm wondering how you even got interested in Spanish.
Did you
grow up in Nebraska?
I grew up in Nebraska, and I have a blog at University of Nebraska Press right now that's about immigration, about what you just presented. And what happened is I met a Cuban refugee family when I was a very little girl, and they took me in and they started teaching me Spanish and about their culture, and that was it.
Well, I do notice something you're wearing around your neck is a shell, and I recognize that shell as a symbol of a pilgrim on the Camino de Santiago de Compostela in Spain.
Yes.
And you walked this Camino, this pilgrimage.
Yes, I walked it in its entirety this past summer.
That's recent.
Yes. It's the second time I've been on the Camino.
Well, you and I are both very fond of that. And I happen to be wearing a shell around my neck also, because I also was a pilgrim.
I noticed
that. Am a pilgrim. Do we ever stop being a pilgrim
once
we walk it?
No, we never stop.
So you were already fluent in Spanish when you walked the Camino because of your years of studying Spanish.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I have my PhD from the Universidad Autónoma de Madrid, and I've lived in Spain a lot. So Spain's like home for me, too. I have a lot of homes.
My husband went to the University of Madrid back years ago, before you were even born, probably.
Yeah, beautiful experiences.
So you decided to write this book, but it wasn't like a year or two ago. You did these interviews quite a while ago.
Right. I was working at a community college in Nebraska, and in the book I tell that I really came back from living in Spain because they had a Title 6A grant comparing Mayan and Winnebago, Mayan culture with Winnebago, Nebraskan, Native American culture. And I was so intrigued, I left Spain and came back to work under that grant and work at that college. So we did the research, but then we wrote the book together on the phone. Sometimes I would visit Nebraska, and it took us a really long time because she's a mother and I work full-time at a community college.
Now, when you're saying she, I might remind people that you're referring to your co-author, Martha Florinda Gonzalez.
Yes, Martha.
So Martha, she goes by. So the two of you work together on this book. When did you start working on it?
I think it was in 2005.
Yeah, because I know you, some of your interviews, for example, you interviewed Jose, and it was in 2005, say, in your book. So you've been working on this book for quite a while. And this co-author that you have, how did you meet her?
Oh, I think it was It was a God moment, I say, because I just started going to local churches and asking people to introduce me to the Mayans, and she was there. And I had a book by CACLA, which is a very powerful women's group in Guatemala, of Mayans who work together as women to come together and heal their wounds from all of those years of civil war. And I had the book, and she said, I know all these women. I've worked with them in Guatemala. They were all on the cover. And so that was just the beginning, and we're still very, very close friends, and we collaborate a lot on this whole issue of immigration.
Well, I enjoyed the paragraph that you wrote in your book. This is on page 32, where you meet Martha. You say, I met Martha, some of the other Mayan women, and Jose, a former Guatemalan Army soldier, at a Catholic church in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
Would you read the rest of that paragraph?
Sure, I'd love to. Quiet and humble Latinos gathered there, and eventually it was standing room only. I had notified the priest of my research interests so that he could inform the congregation and facilitate my conversations with the Mayan women. However, when he introduced me and turned the pulpit over to me without warning, I was overcome by fear. Passing before the eyes of the crowd, I fumbled my way to the front of the church, faced the congregation, and began speaking to them in Spanish. For the first time since I had moved back, I didn't feel like I was actually in Nebraska at all. It was more like I was in Santiago Atitlan, Santa Catarina Palopó, Chichicastenango, Huehuetenango, Quetzaltenango, or Chiapas. As is customary among people from this culture, I was treated with utmost respect and attention. Suddenly, no one was moving or talking. I explained I was a profesora, instructor in a college for the comunidad, the community, and that I was researching Guatemalan Mayan women authors and wanted to hear about Mayan women's experience in the United States. I explained my belief that it is only through dialogue that we can understand one another better. After a split second of silence, the entire congregation broke into applause, which shamed and shocked me. I scurried back to my pew.
This is Anne Sittig, and she is reading from her book, The Mayans Among Us, and telling us how she met her co-author, Martha Florinda Gonzalez. What is the overview of your book? How do you have your book set up, Anne?
How is it set up? Mm-hmm. We start off by telling their lives in Guatemala as children, and then we talk about their lives in Guatemala as children, then we move into an explanation of the Civil War, what happened during the Civil War, what caused it, and what the soldier suffered, because luckily I met a soldier, and I interviewed him too, and then it tells about their decision to leave because of poverty, and then the actual journey to El Norte, crossing the borders. And then it focuses on their lives in Nebraska, on their religious practice and the way they live in their small communities in Nebraska. And then the last chapter is about the meatpacking plant and the work they do there.
Yeah, well, the preface is written by your co-author, Martha.
Martha.
She writes the preface. And, of course, as you read, you're telling this in the first person. You're the one speaking. Now, you have in the title, The Mayans. But I'm not sure we understand what you mean by that. Because when I think of Mayans, I see these sculptures like in the Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City, and these profiles, and the Mayan culture on the Yucatan Peninsula. But I'm not sure I know how modern-day Mayans that you are talking about. Who are these people?
Yes, we were a little embarrassed and ashamed as researchers at the college when we realized we all assumed that Mayans were they were a civilization that was gone, no? And the Mayans are alive, and they speak their Mayan languages, and they live in Guatemala, Belize, Mexico, and they come to the United States of America, and they live here too. So the people in the book, these are Mayans. These are people who grew up speaking Mayan languages, and they've come to the U.S. A lot of them don't speak Spanish. And then learning English is some other far-off dream. So I think a lot of us make that mistake of thinking this is an ancient civilization when it is still very much alive. And the same happened with the Winnebago Native Americans when we worked with them on the grant. At the end, I was very ashamed, and I went to apologize to them because I had grown up and lived in Lincoln, Nebraska my whole life, and I didn't know anything about Winnebago Native American culture. And they just said, it's okay, Anna. Indians are the best kept secret in the United States of America. And I thought, wow. So this has really helped give me perspective and hopefully the reader's perspective on the fact that these indigenous populations are very much alive and among us.
Well, I think some of the assumptions, for example, we even call them Latinos, but they don't, their language they speak is not derived from Latin like Spanish is.
No.
So we assume they're Latinos. We assume they're Catholic. We have all these assumptions about them, I think, and read your book and, oh, that's not quite right. So if we don't call them Latinos, you have a couple of terms that you use in your book. And for example, Jose is an example, not of an indigenous person.
Yes.
So who are these people that you talked to, that you met?
These are indigenous people, and they identify themselves as Mayan indigenous, and then there's more than 20 Mayan languages, so they'll say Maya Mam or Maya Conjobal to describe which language they speak or which culture they belong to under the Mayan umbrella. And Jose, there are a lot of people in Guatemala who either deny their indigenous race or they simply are not Mayan. And so he is, it's more their mestizo. They call them Ladino with a D instead of T. And they are descendants of the Europeans. But many people say the Ladinos have indigenous blood too. They just deny it.
My guest is Ana Sittig. She, on her book, it's Ann Sittig. And she wrote a book about the Mayans among us. And you interviewed these people and learned about their cultures. And when we have an idea, like we assume that they're poor, but our idea of poor in the United States is quite different. And you quote one of the people who was explaining, what is the difference in, would you explain the difference in a poor Guatemalan and a poor American?
I think poverty is becoming more common in the United States now with this economic crisis. But poverty for them means no food, no clothing, no transportation, and either no home or a home that's not adequate. And so they come here because they're poor, because they have nothing and they have nothing to lose. So they're kind of gambling with their life to find a way out. And so when they come to America and they see our definition of poor, I think she says in the book, you know, they have a car, they have a garage to put the car in. They, for them, we're not poor. And so I think that's a really important message for us to ask, who are these immigrants? Why did they come? And what are they doing here? And to see how privileged we all really are if we have food on the table and we have a warm place to sleep.
And that also helps explain why, if they come to this country and their living conditions are less than what we might enjoy ourselves, but it's better than where they came from.
Yes, it is. And I talk about that a little bit in the book, too, dealing with the social service agencies, where, for example, the Mayans live in extended family groupings. Always, they live with the entire family, the grandparents, the children. The grandchild, everyone is together. And so they set up camp like that here, and then they can end up in trouble with the social service agencies and be deported because you have to live with your husband and wife and your children and not mix a lot of families in one household here. So they bring up a lot of issues that I had never even thought about. I find it really intriguing to talk to them about their life and their practices and then those conflicts that they encounter here, because it really is a cultural conflict when people don't understand why they want to live together in one house like that.
Well, I mentioned some of the assumptions that we have, that we think we know these people and that we assume that they are all Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And did you find that was true?
No. And there's a chapter, the reason there's a chapter about religion is because it just came forth as the center of their lives. Since they don't speak a lot of English, they don't really have opportunities to have social encounters. And the church provides that social time for them. And besides, they're just really religious people. They've been religious in their own country. There's an overview of religious practice in Guatemala and why it's continued to change from the Mayan beliefs to Catholicism to Protestantism to evangelicalism. It was amazing to me how many evangelical churches there were in these small towns and also Catholic churches. And I explain why they choose the church they choose and follow what they follow. But I think for me, the most important thing is how religious they are. They're deeply religious people.
Well, I also, from what I read, there was not just religious, but spiritual.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed your description. This was on page 84 in your book. Well, you go back to this overview of religion with the conquistadors coming from Spain and imposing Catholicism. But there's a section where you describe how a prayer.
I love this part too.
What a prayer is like. Would you read that?
I love this part. We don't even have a word like religion in our language. For us, it is life itself. Respect, dignity, love for one's neighbor. All these things are the presence of God. One way the Maya prays is by blowing huh into one's hand. Before a man cuts down a tree, he asks permission from the earth by saying huh, because the earth is his mother. My parents taught me this prayer, and even now I do this prayer for many things. But it doesn't translate well because it doesn't have words. It comes from the heart. Martha thus shared her Mayan spirituality with those in attendance in a nonverbal way. She can't communicate with them in English, nor in Kangxobal, her Mayan language, and although she speaks Spanish, some of them don't. Mayan spiritual practices, such as this, exude from the women organically. And I'd like to say that the beginning of that was a quote from Calixta Gabriel Hikin, a Mayan writer who also lived in California. She fled her country as well. And then this happened when Martha and I attended a Latina Leadership Network conference of the California Community Colleges together. And she decided they were having a fashion show. And I asked her if she wanted to be in the fashion show with her traje. And she said no, because that's her dress. It's not for a fashion show. But then she was dressed so beautifully that the women convinced her. And then that's what she did. She went around the room blowing across her hands at all the participants.
I might mention that you just cupped your hands together.
Yeah.
Like you might if you were putting water in your hands to drink.
And she blew across. And then later I asked her what that meant. It was really a beautiful moment of, you know, nonverbal communication.
Well, since you mentioned the traje, I might spell that T-R-A-J-E.
Mm-hmm.
What role does that play in the Mayan women's lives?
That's what they've always worn. And it's also become a way for them to show their economic prowess. They know that they are the ones who make the traje, so buying local clothing helps support their culture and their cultural practices. And so they've always worn their traje, always. Always, from the time they were little girls. And so there's a section in the book, and that's really important to me too, about when they're crossing the border and they have this coyote who's going to take them. And then there's a moment they're bringing American clothes, like a sweatsuit or something. They usually wear sweatsuits. That's what they mostly wear.
And here in the United States.
Yeah, here in the United States. So there's this moment when they take off these. And these trajes are beautiful. They can cost $500.
In fact, I was surprised at how expensive they are.
Very expensive. Wow. Very expensive. They can cost $500 depending on how ornate they are. And so they take their traje off and they leave it there and then they don't wear it in the United States anymore. So I think any of us can relate to that, how we would feel if we suddenly had to dress in a way that was completely opposite of the way we've always dressed our whole life.
My guest is Ann Sittig, and her book is The Mayans Among Us, Migrant Women and Meatpacking on the Great Plains, specifically in Nebraska. Now, we've mentioned in passing the Civil War in Guatemala, and I think most people, it hasn't even been on their radar screen that there even was a Civil War in Guatemala, much less how long it lasted, and even less our role in this Civil War. What was the role of the United States in a Civil War in Guatemala?
Well, this was back in the 50s when we were that's when it started in 54, and we were very afraid of any infiltration by communists. And so any time there was any activity because what started, there was guerrilla activity in Guatemala that they said was similar to Fidel Castro's Cuba, and then the United States got involved. We also had strong economic interests there. And so we were backing the military that was fighting against the guerrilla. In the book, too, we even say that they even accused the religious community of supporting the guerrilla. So it's like any civil war. It's very confusing. And there's all these changing alliances. And the victims, the great victims, were the 60 to 80% indigenous population who was just farming, subsistence farming. It's a huge tragedy. We have many tragedies happening today, too. So for me, this book was actually really important. It was important to write a book that would be anti-war. This is trying to give a very human face to the victims of these kinds of genocides. And we have a tremendous refugee crisis in the world right now. And I think our history continues to repeat itself, and it's always good to go back for a moment and look at history and ponder over what's happened and what's happening now and how could we do things differently.
You know what? I was wondering in this day of the internet if the CIA director at that time, CIA director was named Alan Dulles, he was on the board of an American corporation.
The United Fruit Company.
And I wonder if that could have been kept secret now, today, maybe so, that our CIA director was on the board of this American company.
I think it was known.
Interest in Guatemala.
I think it was known at that time that he was the director. It was common information. But it's very interesting in Guatemala because if you talk to people who worked for the United Fruit Company, they love the United Fruit Company because they had work, they had housing, they had a retirement. But the effect that company was having on the country and on the indigenous population, they were taking the economic gain out. They weren't leaving it there. So when some land started to be redistributed, that's when the United States stepped in and backed the military.
Well, there was a commission that found human rights violations by the United States during that time. And then there was a conclusion. This is on page 51. And when the UN, what did the UN say?
Well, I was looking back for when the United Nations started and wrote their charter. Again, going back to history to say, why are we allowing these wars to happen, these genocides to happen? And so the charter says, it's here in the book, that we must stop war, and we have to defend fundamental human rights and the worth of all human persons. Do you want me to read that little part?
Yes, if you would, please.
The statute of the International Court of Justice is an integral part of the Charter, focused on saving succeeding generations from the scourge of war through reaffirming fundamental human rights and the worth of all human persons, practicing tolerance and living together in peace without using armed force, and promoting the economic and social advancement of all peoples.
So this is from the UN.
The United Nations Charter, which was signed in 1945 after the World War.
So you're quoting the UN Charter from 1945. And then this next paragraph that concludes this chapter, this is you speaking, isn't it?
Yes. Do you want me to read?
Yes, if you would, please.
Possibly we need to heed the call of the United Nations. We must take a look at history and stop the repetition of arms production, sales, distribution, and use. Jose was a soldier in a genocidal war caused by defined economic interests and gains for the United States. Is it a war that needed to occur? And what were the circular results of the war in terms of U.S. economic production and the labor pool that enhances it? Although they were both educated and gainfully employed, both Jose and Marta, out of impotence, fear, and hope, opted to leave Guatemala and seek out a better life in the United States.
This is author Ann Sittig reading from her book, The Mayans Among Us, Migrant Women and Meatpacking on the Great Plains. And you tell us in your book how terrible that civil war was.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe the effect on the population. And we see then why they would be motivated to seek a better life in spite of all that they had to go through to get to the United States. And there's this wonderful movie. It was so well done. It was partially funded by PBS TV. And it was called El Norte. And this is one of the chapters in your book. And I think maybe people saw this. This was some years ago, the movie was. And it was...
I think it was in the 90s.
No, it was earlier than that, actually. It was. It came out in the United Kingdom in November 1983, and then it made its premiere in New York City in January of 84. And this was partially funded by PBS. But do you remember the story?
Yes. I showed that movie a lot in my class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is popular in Spanish classes.
Yes.
And just briefly, tell us what El Norte was about.
It's about two young people who take off from
indigenous.
Their village. Indigenous. Yes, two young Mayan indigenous people who take off from their village one night to cross the borders and get to the United States. And then their struggles with English and with finding work and making a new life for themselves is a beautiful film.
It is, and it has humor.
Yes.
And I think it would help people understand the situation and why these indigenous people left Guatemala to make it across through Mexico to the United States. And, of course, there are a lot of horror stories there. The story of Jose as a soldier, I mean, he had that was really tough. It was brutal mm-hmm. what Jose suffered as a soldier. And he was better off than some of the other people were.
Mm-hmm.
So when he came to the United States, you were able to talk to him in Spanish then,
yes.
unlike the other people, you had to have an interpreter.
Actually, we always spoke in Spanish. So I think I say that sometimes some of the women, it's very slow, little by little, but they manage to communicate in Spanish. All the women I interviewed, but some of the women, one woman tells Juana how when she arrived, she didn't speak Spanish and it was so hard on her. But she had learned by the time I spoke with her. And with Jose in Spanish.
Well, there's so many stories because the women, little by little, give tell you their stories, and you produce them in the book. Now, in the title of your book is Meatpacking on the Great Plains, and we haven't even gotten a chance to talk about this. So, Anna, I'd like you to come back next week and tell us about these women's lives, more about their lives, and about their work. And how they felt about that. Because you are very even-handed. It's not a hatchet job. I admire the way you approach this whole subject. And so I want to talk to you more about that you'll come back next week.
All right. Thank you.
We are going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, author Karen Halverson Schreck takes us back to the 1930s and the plight of Mexican migrant farm workers in the United States. Her main character takes a stand for the workers' rights when their camp is raided and workers are shipped back to Mexico. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Shasta College Spanish instructor Ann Sittig, author of The Mayans Among Us, Migrant Women in Meatpacking on the Great Plains. After a break, author Karen Halverson Schreck takes us back to the 1930s and the plight of Mexican migrant farm workers in the United States. Her main character takes a stand for the workers' rights when their camp is raided and workers are shipped back to Mexico. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on NSPR. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Donald Trump has proposed immigration reform that would involve mass deportation of immigrants who are in the United States illegally. This deportation plan has echoes of a largely forgotten chapter of American history. In the 1930s, about 1 million people were forced out of the United States across the border into Mexico. It wasn't called deportation, but repatriation, returning people to their native country. But about 60% of the people in the Mexican repatriation drive were actually U.S. citizens of Mexican descent. My next guest's latest novel, Broken Ground, is set in the Dust Bowl during the Great Depression. Karen Halverson Schreck's short stories have won awards, including a Pushcart Prize and an Illinois Arts Council grant. A previous novel, While He Was Away, was a finalist for the 2012 Young Adult Book Award. Karen received her doctorate in English and creative writing from the University of Illinois at Chicago. But when she was an undergraduate at Wheaton College, Karen Schreck lived across the hall from a fellow theater student named Sharon Stern. Sharon now lives in Chico, and she and Karen have remained friends over the years. Karen Schreck, welcome. I have invited your friend Sharon to join us, so let me tell listeners a little bit about Sharon. She was born and raised in Chico. Her father was a professor of botany at Chico State for 35 years. She graduated from Wheaton College in Illinois with a degree in art and theater, and she's worked in the arts for over 30 years as a database manager, software consultant, and business analyst. Sharon met her husband, Eddie, while doing agricultural development work in Central America. So, welcome, Sharon Stern.
Thank you.
And Sharon, it's thanks to you that I even found out about Karen's book.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Karen and I met more than 30 years ago while at college. We both were in a theater group together. There was a group at Wheaton College called Workout. We would get together twice a week for a couple of hours and do physical exercises and vocal exercises and mental exercises, which bonded us very tightly together as a group. And that was the group that was cast and presented plays. A number of people from that group have gone on to become professional actors, but I think all of us, Karen and I included, are just better people as a result. So that's how Karen and I met. We lived across the hall for a semester in a funky little apartment place, and there were more ties that brought us back together. My husband's from Guatemala. Karen ended up adopting two children from Guatemala, so that ties us together as well.
Was she able to make it to your wedding?
Were you at my wedding, Karen? I remember that well as well. Yeah. she was in the area. I don't know what was going on, but.
Well, you know, I was surprised to hear that you were a theater major, Sharon. I wouldn't have guessed that.
No.
But neither of you went on to a career in theater.
No.
And I think that may be reassuring to undergraduates when they're fretting over, oh, gosh, what am I going to major in? Something I'll have to do the rest of my life. And the two of you have gone on to carve careers separate from theater. But you said that that particular professor was
He was an amazing man, and he just made us better human beings. He opened our eyes and our ears to the humanity of each and every person on the earth. And how can you not be a better person for that? So,
well, I wanted to ask Sharon, I want to ask your friend Karen about this book that she has written that is called Broken Ground. And Karen, I don't think this was the book you started out to write, was it?
No. Nancy, my original intention was to explore an aspect of my mom's life, her part of her story. Like my main character, Ruth, my mom lost her first husband when she was young and had to find a way to recreate her life despite difficult circumstances. My mom, like Ruth, made a radical move, leaving Oklahoma and traveling across the country alone to attend college in California, at a time when, at least in her cultural background, women just didn't do that sort of thing. So Broken Ground is set during the 1930s, and I immediately thought, with that Oklahoma to California move, of the Grapes of Wrath and the WPA photographs of that time. But I wanted to explore other experiences while I, at the same time, honored those sources and the reality of Dust Bowl refugees. So I started expanding my research, and one day I stumbled across a black and white photograph on the internet. The picture showed a crowd of worried, really tired-looking people being unceremoniously herded onto a train. And when I first saw that picture, I thought, oh, I'm in the wrong era. This is the 1930s, the Holocaust. It had that kind of feeling about it. And then I read again the caption that went with the picture, and I read for the first time, Mexican repatriation, 1930s. And I thought, what is that? And that's when my research took on a whole new direction, and the story took on a very different sense of urgency for me.
Mm-hmm. Because when I first heard about this repatriation that went on back in the 30s, I thought, gosh, how did I miss this chapter in American history? I thought, golly, that's a real gap in my knowledge. And then I've come to discover that it wasn't just me.
No, it absolutely wasn't just you. It was me too, and a lot of other people that I've spoken with, many, many people that I've spoken with, have had the same experience of being shocked by learning about this aspect of our national history. It really has been ignored by the majority of the population, and some might even say suppressed. There's only one authoritative book about it that I know of, and which I read multiple times and I would encourage you to read too, which is called Decade of Betrayal, Mexican Repatriation in the 1930s. And that book is by Francisco Valderrama and Raymond Rodriguez. So as I was searching and finding out, you know, nuggets of information about what happened, but then also finding many gaps in the description of the experience, I knew that I had to write about it because I wanted to try and understand why it wasn't something, this repatriation or deportation without due process of 1 to 2 million people of Mexican heritage, 60% of whom were U.S. citizens, you know, why I hadn't heard about this in history class along with, say, the Japanese internment camps.
My guest is Karen Halverson Schreck, and she has written a novel, Broken Ground, and you say it was inspired by your mother's life. One difference is how they lost their husband. So would you open your book to pretty much the beginning of the story and tell us about this character? And you recount the story in the first person. And I was curious about how you chose that.
Yeah, the novel Broken Ground is written in the first-person present tense, so there's a real immediacy about it. And it was attractive to me because, though on the level of plot, there's a huge journey that takes place, and many people have said it's kind of a plot page-turning narrative, so that there are lots of events and changes that transpire. What I really wanted to focus on was the internal transformation of my main character and Ruth, and so that's why I decided to go for the immediacy of first-person present.
Well, if you would turn page 4 in your book, where you describe the how hot it is there where they are. There was a heat wave in March, and this blizzard that blew over, even affecting New York and Washington, D.C. And you say in your book, just last week, according to accounts, a fog of prairie dust shrouded the Statue of Liberty. Now, I'm guessing you didn't make that up, Karen.
No, I did a lot of research, and again, that's another element of history that surprised me, too. There was a particular dust storm that hit the plains that was described as 2 miles high, and it traveled 2,000 miles before hitting the East Coast. And there was a period of hours where this prairie dirt covered landmarks like the Statue of Liberty, and also the White House turned, as I say in the book, less than white as well. So for East Coasters, this was more of an inconvenience, but obviously it plagued the everyday lives of so many people in the Midwest. So I'll go ahead and read from that passage, which describes the experience of Ruth's husband, Charlie, whose job that he has that has provided their first home for them as newlyweds, is working on an oil rig in East Texas. So they've left behind her family home, their family home, actually, in a small town in Oklahoma, and moved away, which was important for Ruth to have happen. On the worst days, Charlie says he and the other fellows on the rig measure visibility in inches, not feet. Static electricity crackles in the air. Blue flames leap from metal equipment and barbed wire fences, making dangerous work all the more so. One man bumps up against another. They generate a spark so powerful it can knock them both to the ground. Charlie doesn't complain, but round about noon every day, even when the sky is a stark blue ceiling marked only by the searing sun, no dust to be seen, not even on the far horizon, I'll turn sick with worry. Sometimes the dust gets so thick in the nose and throat, the body can barely breathe. Sometimes, unattended, that thickness turns to dust pneumonia, and then a body simply can't. And then there's heat stroke, the most common ailment.
My guest is Karen Halverson-Schreck. She is just reading from Broken Ground, a novel, and this is taking place right now. They are in Texas. But then we find out, well, you've mentioned that your mother was a young widow. And would you turn to the section where your main character, Ruth, is saying that she likes to read to this young girl, Edna Faye, and they have a favorite fairy tale. Would you read that section?
Yes, this section depicts a relationship that Ruth has with the little girl who lives next door, who's one of the Roustabout's kids, another person who works on the oil rig. And one of the things that this section brings out, which is going to be a through line for the novel, is that Ruth, besides her love for her husband and her desire to build a new life that is separate from the one in which she was raised, she loves learning and has a great desire to teach. So I'll read this scene now, and I think that kind of reflects on those facts about Ruth. I read a tale to Edna Faye from my copy of the Fairy Tales of the Brothers Grimm. We choose Rapunzel, her favorite, and one of mine, too. Why do you like this story so much? I asked her once. The tower, Edna Faye answered, as if the greatest joy in any life would be to be locked away alone, all by oneself in a quiet place, with only hair to grow and a guard to deliver regular meals. I like the story for an entirely different reason, the escape. Edna Faye probably would be content if we never got to that part, but I always read on to the happily ever after end. I read on. The sun sinks, the shirts soak, the minutes tick-tock, the shadows gather, deepening, clinging to one another. I turn page after page. It hits me near the happily ever after end. My teaching got the best of me. I neglected to hitch a ride out to Charlie, bearing a jug of cold water and wet towels. It's too late now. I will visit him on the rig tomorrow. I turn another page, listening for the morning dove. Instead, there's a sound like I've never heard before, a sound like trains colliding. Our little house shifts. The sofa lurches. The window rattles. The jar from which Edna Faye drank falls from the kitchen table and shatters on the floor.
This is Karen Schreck reading from her novel, Broken Ground, and she's just been reading to the young neighbor when there is an explosion, and we can guess that was her husband involved in that. And then what happens to Ruth then immediately following her husband's death?
After Charlie dies in the blowout, Ruth's desire to escape her family of origin is quashed. Her parents and Charlie's mother come back and basically clean out the little life they've built, and Ruth returns to the town in Oklahoma in which she was raised. And I think, you know, that feeling of slipping back into a life you thought you'd lived behind into old patterns and relationships can be an incredible shock coupled with her grief. And she really begins to struggle with what she calls her black moods, black fogs.
And I noticed, Karen, how many times this idea of freedom and the story of Rapunzel, she says the idea of escape appeals to her. Mm-hmm. And then she's working in the library, and there comes up that image again of, and who got set free in the library, Karen?
the little, you mean?
Yeah, would you, maybe you'd like to read.
The mice were set free, but in the way that Ruth's liberated, that's the place that's Ruth's liberation as well, because of a friend that she has here, there, Ms. Berger, who is the librarian.
And you said that everything was real quiet there at the library, and
sure,
Ruth
yeah.
says...
Read from that part.
Yeah, uh-huh.
For a long moment, we are quiet, so quiet that along with the wind, I hear something scurry across the floor. The library is often overridden with mice. When it is, they wreak havoc on the books, nibbling covers and pages. We are good at catching mice, Miss Berger and I, wielding brooms and boxes. I was the one who usually carried our captives outside. It was satisfying to see them shake off their trembling and bolt, their sleek brown and gray bodies darting into the bushes, disappearing among twigs and leaves. By some kind of grace they could not possibly understand, they were free.
So here again is that image of, in this case, the mice were free.
Mm-hmm.
And in that paragraph, you mentioned the name of the librarian, and you characterize that librarian. It's a very nice characterization. This is on page 68 in your book, Karen.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't surprised to read this, that you said, needless to say, I love libraries. And that didn't surprise me.
Yes, I do. They were my refuge as a child, too. So,
are they still your refuge?
This is
Karen?
Sharon asking you this question. Yeah.
Are they still your refuge? Because you work at Wheaton Public Library,
I
right?
I do. Since this book was after I wrote the book, just prior to the publication, I took a part-time job at the Wheaton Public Library, which is the very library I grew up in, spending long, you know, afternoons there. So it's really a full circle feeling every time I walk through that door.
In fact, I think this librarian that we've just been talking about is really the hero of the book. She is such a heroic figure that I'd like you to, maybe you'd like to read that section about the librarian.
Sure. Working side by side from day to day with Miss Berger, I confirm what I already assumed. She is quite the free thinker. Years back, when Charlie wanted to talk more deeply about Darwin, she was the person to whom he turned. I knew about their exchange. Charlie relayed their conversation to me. But now I witness other examples of the confidence Miss Berger inspires. When women are in trouble, say their husbands are drinkers or gamblers or violent, or maybe their husbands are fine, upstanding men, but the women are having health problems that lead to medical tests, and their husbands and doctors won't let them see the results, or let the women give their opinions on the results, for whatever the reason, and there are so many, women come to Miss Berger for advice they can't get elsewhere. At least a few times each week, Miss Berger pulls Gray's Anatomy or an Encyclopedia Britannica from the shelf, or one of the few scholarly journals in that the library owns, and reads and interprets information that might prove helpful to the person in need. It's the least I can do, she says, when anyone tries to thank her. You'd do the same for me if our situations were reversed.
This is Karen Schreck reading from her novel, Broken Ground. And we're getting to know the main character, Ruth, who recounts the story in the first person. We've just met the librarian, who's a heroic figure in the book. But we haven't really gotten to what I mentioned earlier, that your book is about what is really happening during the Depression. And your main character is offered a scholarship, to a four-year scholarship in California, and her dad is not pleased at all that she's going to do that. But she encounters signs like, jobless men keep going. Mm-hmm. We can't take care of our own. And I'm sure that was based on your research, that these signs actually existed.
Yes, absolutely. There's some very, there are photographs all over the internet of that exact sign from the 30s. And so as she moves to California, I mean, her concerns have really been with the Dust Bowl refugees that she knows, with the impoverished people or people who are, you know, struggling through the Depression, who are white. And it's only when she goes to California that her world kind of cracks open and she realizes that other people are being impacted by it as well, people of other ethnicities and races.
Well, this seems kind of like the way your eyes were open to this whole subject, Karen.
Yeah. There's a, I mean, really that odyssey, Ruth is on a journey, and it's very similar to what I did go on in terms of trying to dig up what really happened. There just wasn't a lot of information about it. And so, as with Ruth, the knowledge came to me gradually about what really happened with the deportations in that time.
Well, for example, your character Ruth is on a train, and she encounters this government official. And what is his job? What's he doing on the train? This is you describe this on page 68 in your book.
Right, right. So she has just arrived in Los Angeles after this long train journey. She's exhausted and confused, and she realizes that her suitcase is not to be found. It's left on the train, and she's sitting in the station. And she witnesses lines of people coming through the station, heading toward the train, being kind of herded toward the train platforms by government officials and other kind of, you know, local police officers, that kind of thing. And so the man, she strikes up a conversation with the man because she wants to go get her, try to find her suitcase. And he responds this way. The man flashes what I suppose is his winning smile. There's government work going on here. Can't let you interrupt that. To my amazement, he chucks me under the chin. FDR wouldn't like it, see. I'd have to tell him about you, and he'd take real offense. As proof of his connection to the president, he flashes a document bearing a government seal. So take your basket, Little Red Riding Hood, and hurry on back to your seat. And I'll rustle up your suitcase if it's there. But we got to get these people boarded. They're going back to where they belong, courtesy of the United States government, back to Mexico.
And she says, why? Mm-hmm. It's risky to ask. I might irritate him, but I'm curious. And then he says,
repatriation, that's why. It's what these people have wanted and needed for a long time, a free ride back to their mother country. We're giving it to them, and we're making more jobs for Americans to boot. Initially, Ruth thinks that this is, you know, reasonable.
Legitimate.
It's a good thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that's the way it's presented. We're sending them back. They want to go, so we're sending them back. We're repatriating them, mm-hmm. not deporting mm-hmm. them. We're giving them this ride back to their country where they're from and making jobs available for Americans who are out of jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So did you think maybe the fact that there were so many men, and there were men really out of work during the Depression, that this was the impetus for the Hoover administration saying, we got to do something about this?
Yeah, the Hoover administration initiated this program in 1929. It was actually the Secretary of Labor who initiated it. And they were trying to find quick solutions for the crash. And so what they decided was to just pick up people. There were raids, there were sweeps of entire communities, pick people up and transport them. It was by far more of a Mexican American population or Mexican immigrant population that was affected. But they also did some of this with the Filipino and Japanese population as well. Of course, the Mexican border is a lot closer, so it was a lot more expeditious and expensive to focus their efforts there. And it was profiling. It was a type of profiling. They didn't really bother to ask for paperwork or how long a person or an entire family might have inhabited a community, what their status was as citizen.
Well, it seems to me we as a country, we're not proud of this, so we don't teach it in our history classes. So how did you research something that is pretty much hidden?
Yeah. Well, I was astonished because once I learned about it, I started searching for books on it that addressed it. It is referenced in The Grapes of Wrath, and Woody Guthrie makes reference to it in one of his songs, but there really wasn't much out there. I quickly discovered a book entitled Decade of Betrayal that was written by Francisco Valderrama and Raymond Rodriguez. Rodriguez is no longer living, but he lost his father, never saw his father from the time that he was about 10 years old because his father was deported and not allowed back. And that book was just illuminating to me. They've by far done the most research, and a lot of their research is through the stories that people told, the next generation of people who were either able to come back as the children of those people who were deported, or who somehow were not deported along with their parents and stayed. So it's built through that. And then, but other than that book, there really isn't a lot. I was learning things from people's accounts on YouTube. It was baffling to me how little there was, and how much information was actually contradictory. So, in the text of my book, I refer to it as a program because it's often referred to a program in the newspaper accounts, in political addresses, that kind of thing. But it was actually not a program. It was more insidious than that, kind of more under the radar, or it was a program. I apologize. I'm messing up right now. It was a program, not an act.
Mm-hmm. So it was not a federal act. This was not an
not
act.
Not a federal act. It was a program that was implemented by cities, counties, and also large corporations. So it kind of spread in that way. The word spread that this was a solution to the job crisis, to the current job crisis, financial crisis.
Yeah. My guest is Karen Halverson Schreck, and her novel, Broken Ground, deals with a repatriation program that took place during the 1930s that was an actual program. The fact that your book is a novel doesn't mean that much of what you write in your book is true and accurate as best you could uncover when you were writing this book.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I did as much research as I possibly could, and I was in correspondence with Dr. Valderrama, and he was the one who informed me after the book had gone to press that it was indeed a program and not an act. And I tried to, it's just, like there's a couple of lines that reference that, but it tore me up because I had tried so hard to get the historical facts right.
Sure.
But it was too far along in the printing process to change that.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, Karen, about your book, Broken Ground. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Shasta College Spanish instructor Ann Sittig, author of The Mayans Among Us, Migrant Women and Meatpacking on the Great Plains. And we will look forward to hearing more about these stories of these women next week. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.